This month's podcast features Issa Zimmerman, the principal of IKZ Advisors LLC, where she serves as a resource for people in Massachusetts and around the world who are interested in STEM education. She served two terms on Governor Deval Patrick's STEM Advisory Council and is the co-editor and contributor to two books published by the Massachusetts affiliate of ASCD. In this podcast, you'll hear how in her early work with technology education, it was not always an easy sell to schools.
Some were terribly disinterested, some were neutral, and a few were really excited. And those are the few with whom I interacted for quite a while.
How technology should continuously be used to enhance educational best practices.
I think organizations like the Superintendents Organization and the Principals Organizations, those organizations should also be encouraging schools and individual teachers and departments to explore what technology can make available to their students that they couldn't actually do without it.
And how there is much more to a student's education than what they learn in the classroom.
I wish that kids had more of that kind of opportunity to experience high school, not just as an academic, I sit in my seat and I learn this stuff, but as a place where they could do things.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning resources, training, and support. JFY's individualized self-paced curriculum help raise individual and school performances by maintaining grade-level skills and combating learning loss. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. As a principal and superintendent, Issa Zimmerman was a pioneer in bringing technology to schools for instruction and productivity in Massachusetts and started the Massachusetts Association of School Superintendents Technology Task Force. She was also chair of the Commissioner of the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education's Educational Technology Advisory Council for 2 3-year terms, the first 6 years of the task force's existence. A recent conversation with JFY's Executive Director Gary Kaplan began by talking about how she became involved with STEM and technology education.
The first question is, you majored in English and history, and then earned a doctorate in education, and you started your career teaching English and social studies.
Correct.
How and why did you get involved in technology and then end up being such a major STEM advocate?
Do you know, it is so interesting because I don't even know how I got involved or remember how I got involved in technology, but I was the first superintendent in Massachusetts who was pushing the Superintendents Association, which is our organization, encourage people to use technology in schools. But frankly, at this point, I don't remember how it started. I think my husband had something to do with it, George did, because George was an early user of technology. He was a physics professor at Boston University, and so he used a lot of technology in his work and in his teaching. So I may have picked it up from him, but I'm not actually even sure of that. I just was interested in, I thought it had great potential for communication, learning, maintaining relationships, all the good things.
This is around 1990, right? That you were,
I think
you
so.
Were doing that?
I think so.
So when you first started talking to other superintendents about technology, what was the reception?
Well, what you would expect. Some were terribly disinterested, some were neutral, and a few were really excited. And those are the few with whom I interacted for quite a while. And we tried to get the Superintendents Association, MASS, Massachusetts Association of Superintendents, to use technology. And we had a little bit of success. There was a conference run by the MASS and MASC school committees at Gillette Stadium. I was, of course, there. And we did a lot of demonstrations of the use of technology. And of course, as you would expect, some people were very interested and asked us to continue to interact with them, and some people turned their backs and walked away. The organization had its meeting at Gillette for quite a few years, so I always went. I always volunteered to help, and I encouraged people to show what they were doing with the technology.
Okay, but you must have been quite interested in it to have pushed it that hard.
Well, I thought it was exactly what it has become, an avenue for communication, an avenue for learning, an avenue for improvement of the environment. And I don't mean just the weather environment, I mean the living environment, how people work together in places. So to me, it was a no-brainer that it should be established in schools and colleges. And I was at Harvard getting, I can't remember, either my doctorate or my master's, I think probably early on the master's. And they were beginning to do some, Chris Deedy. Well, Chris was absolutely wonderful fellow. I really liked him, and he was very kind to me, and he supported what I was trying to do and helped me when he could. So that was very nice. And he was at the School of Education at the time. He started out somewhere else, south somewhere, but he was smart enough to pursue the School of Education at Harvard. And that, I think, that set him up for his future, because Harvard is a place that has a lot of influence for good and bad, whatever, however you react to it. But from the perspective of technology in schools and the use of technology for learning and teaching and communicating and et cetera, the Graduate School of Education was very, very good. I remember I organized, gosh, way back, I organized an event held in Longfellow Hall. No, not Longfellow, across the way, in the new red brick building at the time, new at the time. And Chris helped me. Chris Deedy helped me. He was there already. So, and we filled the auditorium, 100 people. And a few people who came late couldn't find a seat, so they sat on the floor, which was not necessarily approved of, but we didn't do anything. We were happy to have them all.
That is very early in the day. Now, right at this moment, there's a lot of controversy about online education following the pandemic shutdown. A lot of people are blaming remote education for COVID learning loss. And, the state has banned remote teaching from K-12. What's your opinion of this state of the dialogue right now?
I didn't realize that the state had banned. Nothing like that's come across my screen. You should pardon the expression. I think it's a mistake to stop a movement that has a lot of energy behind it and which produces some really good results. Of course, it's not perfect. I mean, there are problems. I participate in lots of these Zoom meetings these days because people aren't getting together. And I can see, because we see the pictures of everybody, I can see the people who really are into it and the people who aren't. And that's life. That's any enterprise in life has people who approve and people who don't approve, people who use and people who don't use. I think it's foolish of educators to not use technology.
When you say you can see who's into it and who's not, how do you see that? Body language?
Oh, because in all of the Zoom meetings that I participate in, there people's pictures running along the bottom of the screen. So you can move it too. And so you can see how people are, when they don't think they're being watched, how they're reacting. And then you can see how they are when they're on the screen, because it takes that little picture and puts it up at the top. If we were all in the same room, I'd be able to see all of those people.
Right.
So I'm not doing anything that I couldn't do sitting in the room, except that I can meet with people who can't get together at the moment.
So Issa, looking ahead, where do you see technology in education going in the next few years? And what do you think that schools and the department should be doing?
Well, the department should be showing people what potential there is and how technology could be used going forward. I think their role should be to lead and to show the way and to encourage. I think organizations like the superintendents organization and the principals organizations, which I belong to, I still belong to the superintendents organization, but I don't belong to the principals one anymore. But those organizations should also be encouraging schools and individual teachers and departments to explore what technology can make available to their students that they couldn't actually do without it. I mean, and for instance, what they could not actually do without it is they couldn't show things from very far away. I mean, if you want to see what's going on in Saudi Arabia or in Israel or in Paris, you can't do it without the technology. If you want to do it in real time, and even not in real time, you can't do it. So it's an enormous, it's an instrument that allows you to learn and go way beyond the boundaries that are imposed on by space, by normal life, non-technology life. I live in Kenmore Square, as you know, and the Kenmore Square organization, which was created because we were worried about what was happening at Fenway Park, what was happening underneath the overpass, what was happening pretty much everywhere in the square, has been meeting, and it meets on Zoom, which could never have done during the pandemic if we weren't using Zoom. So it's the technology provides a resource, is a resource for communication under practically any circumstances, while real life is not. You know, my father was smart enough. I don't know how he knew. I wish I'd been old enough to ask him that question, but he and my mother got married and left Warsaw just before the Nazis came in. And he and my mother traveled to Lisbon, Portugal, where my father, I had no idea about this. As I say, I wish I'd been clever as a younger person, where he had a beautiful factory just around the corner from a building that now I understand probably was a cooperative, because we owned one entire floor at the time. We had a live-in maid, we had a cook, we had a cleaner. And when my brother was born and little, we had a nursemaid. Now, that's four people working for two and a half people. And really, I wish I'd been smarter. I think I know why he wanted to come to the United States. He was trying to get some distant relatives out of Poland to Portugal. And for some reason, he could not, even though there was a very large Jewish community in Lisbon and everybody was helping everybody, but for some reason he couldn't. So he decided to come to the United States. Again, I wish I had asked, I wish I had known.
You know, you have, Issa, just because of your history, you have an unusual historical, personal historical perspective. Do you think that has colored your worldview, your whole attitude?
Well, I'm sure, because I believe that education does make people aware of certain things in certain ways, which is why education is so important. So I'm sure that what happened to me in Lisbon impacted my life for a long time. I mean, eventually, of course, I became an American and I went to Cornell University, and then I went to, as you know, Harvard. So later on, not so much, but when I first came, yes, absolutely. Further down on Avenue M, so my father can't see that I'm walking with you.
When the education reform bill passed in 93 and the standards started being developed, were you involved in that and the development of the state standards?
I believe so. I don't remember exactly how, now that it's such a long time ago, but I know that I participated in lots of discussions. And I think by that time I was already working in New York. So I was doing it through the technology.
There's, you know, there's a lot of disagreement, conflict around the whole concept of standards-based education and then standardized testing. And, you know, people on one side of it say we need to have standards and we need to know what we're producing here. People on the other side of it say kids should be free to explore their interests and we shouldn't be doing tests. We should be doing portfolios and things like that. Where do you...
They're not mutually exclusive. I'm sorry. I think both elements of both positions constitute what we should be doing. So can I tell you in detail now without them in front of me? No. But I am sure, I believe, and I've done some work in it myself, that that's why I always wanted to create my own school, because then I could make sure that kids learned the way I thought they should learn. I didn't do that. I mean, the closest I came to that is I offered a few courses at the Harvard Graduate School of Education after I got my doctorate. And one of my favorite people, do you know Chris Deedy? Does that name ring a bell?
I know the name, and I met him, centuries ago, but I didn't know him well. Yeah. In fact, I think you introduced me to him maybe 20 years ago.
He was very kind and helped me as much as it made sense, because his job was to be a higher education faculty member and researcher. He was also a researcher.
So part of the, there's always huge arguments about public education, but part of the discussion now, and in fact, it's almost a consensus, is that K-12 education should be connected to the workforce. It should be about learning skills for jobs, and there should be internships, and it should be, it should be career focused, and things like arts and other things that don't necessarily connect directly to the labor market. Much time should not be spent on them. Where do you come?
I don't agree with that. I think regardless of what you end up doing professionally, vocationally, whatever you want to call it, it is important to be aware of all of the aspects of civilization. So the arts, the skills that you need to run things, I think it all should be part of it. And I think it's a mistake to only pay attention to one aspect of that. If I ever, which I never will now, but if I ever... I did create a school at one point, but if I ever were to do anything like that again, that would be one of my main points, is that you need to know about science, you need to know about technology, you need to know about the humanities, you need to be able to write, to read, to speak well, etc.
Well, what is your opinion of the current state of humanities and civic? You were a history major. You started out as a history teacher. What's your opinion of the current state of humanities and history and civics education?
I'm not in the schools very much these days, so I can only talk about what I'm assuming is what's happening. And I think that it's very varied depending upon the school that you go to. If you're in a vocational school, my guess these days, talking to some of my colleagues, is that not much humanities is going on. But I think that's a mistake. I think, you should pardon the expression, a well-rounded education is the answer.
I sort of exempt the tech schools from this discussion because they're tech schools. That's what they're set up to do. But what's happening now is that a lot of academic high schools are starting to incorporate vocational courses, because that seems to be what parents want. They want their kids to be able to get vocational training. So they're bringing in, they're bringing in those courses into high schools. And I don't hear many people clamoring for more civics education or for more arts or for more speech or any of that stuff.
Well, That's always been the case, which is one of the reasons why it was important to have those as requirements in schools, because 90% of the people don't pay attention to that. But I think it's a mistake not to have what we call a well-rounded education. You need to know about technology. You need to know about history. You need to know about literature. You need to know about mathematics and science. To me, it's a no-brainer. And if I were to run a school, boy, but I'm never going to because I'm too old and too tired.
I wouldn't say that. Tired, I wouldn't say that at all. I can't do anything about it. Well, out of all the things that you've done, Issa, you've been a teacher, a principal, a superintendent, you've been an innovator for many years. What achievements are you proudest of?
Well, ironically, I was the first woman in many of those situations.
Okay. Can you speak about that a little bit more? I mean, this is Women's History Month.
I don't remember experiencing very much bias or discrimination because I wasn't paying attention to it. You know, I did what I did. I did it well enough that people weren't complaining about the performance. I was just interested in what I was doing. And I was lucky because George was absolutely supportive in everything and actually occasionally even helped me because physics is one of the most challenging courses in high school, as you know. And he tried to help by making things a little easier to understand. So it is what it is. I did what I did, and I'm not upset that I did it. I'm not unhappy that I did it, and I'm not sad.
When you were starting to get involved in technology in the 1990s, did you run into any, first of all, were there other women doing that? And secondly, did you run into kind of, you know, resistance because you were a woman?
I don't believe so. I mean, I never felt resistance because I was a woman. I felt resistance because it was technology. And actually, the people I worked with, do you know a woman named Shelley Chamberlain? No. Anyway, some of the women I worked with, we all knew what we were doing and we were focused on doing it and weren't paying much attention to all the stuff that was going on around. And actually, we had a number of annual conferences at Gillette Stadium for some reason. And for me, going to Gillette was a long trip. I didn't particularly like it. If they were multi-day conferences, we stayed in a hotel right nearby so we wouldn't have to drive back and forth every time. But it was what it was. I mean, people came, they were interested, or some of them were not. They took advantage of what was being offered. I didn't sense any sexism going on there. Maybe there was, as I say, but I wasn't paying attention to it.
Do you have any particular regrets, looking back over your career?
No, I don't think so.
Is there anything you wish you had done that you didn't do, or vice versa?
Well, sometimes I wish I'd stayed longer in New York rather than coming up to Cambridge. I think I told you how that happened, didn't I?
You may have, but it's a good story. Go ahead. How did we get so lucky?
I kept in touch with about a half dozen of the women from Cornell with whom I had interacted a great deal. And they organized a trip to Mexico on a week date in schedule when I couldn't leave my work. So I said, I'm really sorry, but I can't go with you guys. But then I felt like I deserved a week. So when it was appropriate, I came up to Cambridge because a few of my Cornell friends had come to Cambridge directly, getting masters and doctorates, et cetera. So I called one of my friends and said, I'm coming up. And she made a reservation for me at the Commander Hotel. And one night there was a party at the home of Ted and Nancy Sizer. So I went, and Ted was absolutely the most wonderful guy in education I had ever met. And Nancy was a little bit more, what shall I say, a little bit less warm and friendly. But she deferred to, if it was stuff that he had business with, she deferred to him. So anyway, I came back from my trip to Cambridge and said to my parents, I think I'm going to apply to the School of Education at Harvard. If I get in, I'll go. If I don't get in, I won't go. I'll continue to work in New York. And as you can tell, I got in. And then I decided after getting the MAT that I wanted an EDD. So I applied again and I got accepted immediately because, for one thing, Chris Deedy was there. A few other people whom I'd sort of gotten to know peripherally.
So it was just that accidental.
Yes. Ironically, it was an accident of chance.
And if you hadn't gone up to that party, we might not be sitting here today.
That is correct. I have no idea. The people for whom I was working in New York, I think I told you how I got that job. I saw an ad in the paper and the New York Times cut it out, went down to the place that made the ad. And when I came in, they said to me, "What do you want?" And I showed them the ad and they said, "Okay, sit here at this typewriter and spend half an hour writing something for us." Well, my God, that was nothing. Because remember what I did at Cornell. I'd go to the movies, I'd go to the theater, I'd come racing back up on the public bus, and then I'd have to type a review and hand it in so it could be published in the next Cornell Daily Sun. So it was really nothing. So I did it 20 minutes and they took it away and then they came back.
What did you write? What did you write about?
I can't even remember, to tell you the truth. They came back and said, "You have the job." So I thought, oh, thank you, Cornell. Anyway, it turns out that the people who owned the Hair Publications, HAIRE, they had gone to Cornell. So I think my connection than my great talent.
And was that the magazine?
Housewares Review, one of the advantages of working for Housewares Review, I may have told you this, is that Housewares, at least at the time, I haven't kept up with it, at the time held the largest convention of any organization in the United States in Chicago at McCormick Place. Now, that meant that I went to Chicago several times on their dime, not my dime. Uh-huh. And I had a lovely time and it was such fun walking around. The best part, frankly, wasn't so much the presentations as the exhibit hall. It was, according to them, the largest exhibition in the United States in any profession at the time.
So that was 1961, 62?
Yes, probably, let's see, maybe 63, 62, 63, somewhere
yeah,
in Europe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that was very lucky. Why did you go to Cornell?
Why did I go to Cornell?
You were living in New York, right? Living in Queens.
No,
or Brooklyn, yeah. Why Cornell?
Well, I applied to Swarthmore and got in. And then decided it was just too small and bucolic a place. I wanted something larger and more engaged in community affairs. And of course, Ithaca was nothing without Cornell. So pretty much Cornell didn't run Ithaca, but Cornell influenced a lot of what happened in Ithaca. And I think I told you that I did all the, so I worked for the Cornell Daily Sun and I did all the movie and theater reviews. So I'd have to get downtown, which was not a problem because it would be about 6 o'clock. But getting back at 11 o'clock, I had to get permission from the police at Cornell to be allowed to come into the dormitory at that hour. Now, maybe they don't bother to do that anymore, but at the time, it was very protective.
So, all right. And you enjoyed Cornell, apparently. You had a good
time. I had a couple of fantastic professors. And the Cornell Daily Sun was a wonderful piece of my education. And living in the dormitory, you know, met a lot of interesting women because they were segregated at the time. So, no, I have no regrets about Cornell. And I have no regrets that then I came back home and worked for a year in New York in the housewares industry, and then decided to come to Harvard for an MAT and then stayed and got an EDD.
Was Nabokov at Cornell in those years?
Yes, he was. And I took a couple of classes.
You did? You took classes with Nabokov?
Of course. Why wouldn't you?
Well, of course, why wouldn't you? What do you remember? Anything in particular? Did he talk about butterflies?
No, I don't remember the content. I remember just being there and being interested in having this fellow talk. I don't remember any of the content, quite honestly. Well, no, I think when I look back, I don't remember the content of almost any course I ever took. I mean, what I remember is feeling that having taken the course, I was able to do more than I've been able to do before. But I don't remember the content. I do remember, so because I was very good in math and science in high school, I got into an advanced required freshman year of science and math. They, particularly in the science class, there were mostly boys. I think there were two other girls. The boys were rude to the professor was a person from India, and he spoke with an accent, which was not easy to understand. And the boys would be very rude to him and say, "We didn't understand that." So it was a very unpleasant semester. And I decided not to continue. I decided to go into English and medieval history, believe it or not. So the next summer, at the end of that year, I was walking across the quad, and the professor was walking, and he caught up with me, and he said, "I haven't seen your name on the next course." And I said, "Well, I decided to drop out," because I said it was a terrible experience with all those boys being rude to you. And he said, "Oh, that's just so bad, because I recommended you for the next highest level," which is not what I would have taken automatically, but it was something that he had to do. And I said to myself, why didn't you tell me that at the time? No, really, if he had told me that, I would have stayed in that subject and I'd be teaching math and science. But he didn't, and I didn't. And
well, this is an awfully interesting story. So you might have been, what, a physics major or something
correct,
like that?
Correct.
Well, and yet,
which is ironic because I married a physicist.
Exactly. But also, you've ended up as a major STEM advocate anyway.
Well, because I understand the importance of those things. And just because I didn't continue doesn't mean I don't understand the issue.
Do you think we've gone too far in the direction of STEM?
No, I don't. You don't? So. And I think a lot of that has to do with how it's taught. I mean, if it's taught really well, then you have to think about learning how to write and read, exploring lots of other possibilities. No, I don't think so.
Well, do you have any general thoughts, ideas, perspectives on where the culture as a whole is going and what education can do to, you know, to shape some sort of direction?
Well, I certainly think that education could be much more proactive in helping prepare people for the future. More requirements. I mean, people choose to do things that have nothing to do with what they need to know sometimes. So I think laying out several different, I don't mean a lot of them either, maybe three different pathways that people should be taking would be very helpful, because most people don't know what they're doing when they choose what they choose. So that's one thing. I think having opportunities outside of class to get together on a regular basis, like small groups. And I, again, I look back at James Madison High School. You know, I went to the high school where Ruth Bader Ginsburg went to high school and a few other important people. And one of the things that made my career in high school a real pleasure is that I served on the high school's newspaper, the James Madison High School newspaper. And that meant that I had a few privileges because I had to get into places that normally I wouldn't have gotten into because I was writing something about it. So I wish that kids had more of that kind of opportunity to experience high school, not just as an academic, I sit in my seat and I learn this stuff, but as a place where they could do things. I think being on the student council and writing for the newspaper, those kinds of experiences make the 4 years a really enjoyable and memorable experience.
Well, this is a little bit off topic, but do you have any thoughts or feelings about what's going on in Eastern Europe now?
I am worried that we're going to return to pre-current time attitudes and actions. So I'm a little worried about Russia and Ukraine. So I'm a little worried about it. But I think that the president has said that he'd send it, you know, he'd activate troops, which is interesting because that who wants that to happen? But at least he's threatening, and that's a good thing, because I think that Russia understands threats in a way that sometimes causes their activity to change. So we'll see. But I'm glad, frankly, I'm glad I'm not there now.
I think we can all share that sentiment. My gosh. Well, Issa, thank you very much.
Gary, my pleasure. I've talked a lot.
Well, yeah, but that is the idea.
Thank you.
Well, you have a lot to say, Issa. And
I certainly do.
You do.
I mean, between being born abroad and coming here and then coming from New York to Massachusetts and going all the way up the ladder in education. Yeah, I've had a lot. And being very fortunate. I mean, I think going to Harvard was one of the best things that happened. Going to Cornell was a very good thing. But going to Harvard was even better.
Yeah.
Especially since I live here now.
Indeed. Well, it was a good break for us because it brought you here.
We would like to thank Issa Zimmerman for joining us this month for the JFYNet podcast. You can find more information about Issa and her work on the site ikzadvisors.com. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which also features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free scholastic resources, including this monthly podcast, to support all educational communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.